Well, friends, it is really good to be back home this Sunday for church, although I thoroughly enjoyed my time off. And unfortunately, as I said, I'll be gone again next week, and then back for a week, and then my brother's getting married, so I'll be gone again the following week, and then I'll be home for good. I appreciate the grace you extend to me so that I can have some time off and do some important things. So I did get to travel for about 12 days during my little break here, and I returned to South America, which I'm discovering is just one of the most amazing continents. And this time it was a trip of extremes. And I'm going to show you what I mean by that. So, Joyce, can you click through a couple pictures for me? Wow. The first was to Iguazu Falls. It is on the border of Argentina and Brazil. You can go through again. A couple more. There's several pictures here. So we walk on the Brazil side, and you see, go ahead, more and more, and you get closer, and you walk right into the base where the falls are coming down and the water's going past you. Yeah, it was just rainbows everywhere. It was so much water. And this water flow was a third of its normal. Wow. Because I went in the winter, and it's the dry season. Then the next day we went on the Argentina side, and you start by walking across the Iguazu River. Iguazu means big water. It's really wide. It's pretty shallow, but it looks super calm. And I keep going. Pretty soon you see it falling. And you get closer still. Keep going. Wow. And you're right above a U-shaped end of a gorge. One more picture of this. Wow. You can hold that there. You're over it looking down. And the water is going under you and over both sides. It was phenomenal. The next weekend, I went to the next extreme, the Atacama Desert in Chile. This happens, this strip of green here is San Pedro de Atacama. So that town is built in one of the oasis points of the desert. The desert is the driest desert on Earth except for Antarctica. And it's at about 8,000 foot elevation, the town, surrounded by the Andes, which are all volcanoes. Many of them are 16,000 feet or taller. And they get rain about 2 days out of the year.
Oh, gosh.
For a total of 3/4 inch to 1.5 inches of rain.
Oh, gosh.
So it's a very, very dry place. They have 98% clear skies, and I happened to be there on one of the days we had some clouds. It was beautiful. So you can show a couple more pictures. We went on a tour, sand dunes, just this is the Valley of the Moon, they call it. You can kind of see why they might call it that. Totally incredible landscape. Completely opposite from the weekend before, but stunning. And this one looks like a T-Rex. And they had, there's salt in these mountains, so there's huge rocks of salt on the ground where you're walking. There's borax and calcium and some other minerals that make it look white. That's not snow. And then we saw the stars. That is me under the Milky Way. That's the center of the galaxy. That was one. It was very cool. To see the southern sky in winter, the Atacama Desert's known for being good stargazing because of the low humidity, low light. It's the darkest skies you can get. So I booked a tour and planned my trip around the fact that there'd be no moon out. And the tour guide takes this picture, which is awesome. And then we saw, there's one more picture and you can hold on this. This is a nebula that we saw through the telescope. We also saw a galaxy and cluster stars. And we learned things about how the people of Atacama Desert used the night sky, and we saw the Southern Cross, learned how to find the southernmost pole where there is no star. Like we have the North Star, there is no Southern Star, but you can find that point by using the Southern Cross. So Tony, I show these pictures with people here and everywhere because I want people to know this kind of beauty exists. Even if we can't see these things with our own eyes, knowing the beauty of creation, whether it's falls or desert or stars, galaxies, it gives us that sense of awe, that sense of awesomeness of God. And it reminds us, or at least it reminds me, of just how big God is. And none of us will ever have a full picture of God. But when we visit different places, we get different, it's like you get different facets of it. You get to see different sides of God. And you start building that picture. So one of the easiest and best prayers, and my most common prayer those 12 days was, wow. And that's a beautiful thing to do. And sometimes we have to remind ourselves to go out, look at the moon, wake up, see the sunrise, or look out for the sunset, drive up to the lake, and just say, wow, and be in awe. I also share these to remind us that the world we see is a very limited view, whether we're looking at Shasta Lake or California or the US of A. It's such a small portion of creation. God is at work across the entire universe. And God's beauty and goodness is moving even when there's nobody there to notice. Because that's who God is, a creator of beauty. So I have found in the last few years that travel's really been important for me to see better, to see God better. And we see God better through the people we meet too. If we go expecting to find God in those places, we will. God's present in all people, all cultures, all languages, all nationalities. Everywhere, people are made in the image of God. No person anywhere is outside of God's love and grace. Therefore, no person should be outside our love and grace. In Matthew chapter 10, the author records some of the sayings of Jesus that have been circulating among the believers that were connected with his instructions to the apostles when he sent them out to go make disciples, go tell the world about this love of God, this forgiveness of God. And a colleague of mine described it as if maybe you had quotes on a bunch of 3x5 cards, and he thought, you know, I should probably put them all on one paper someday. So they don't necessarily flow like a narrative does. Some of them have an incredible image of God's grace and care, and some sound really harsh, almost scary. Ultimately, Jesus is assuring his disciples they are in God's care, just as much as a sparrow. And yet, if they go out and be the person of God's kingdom that they're called to be, people will turn on them and hate them. So it's a lot of kind of pros and cons in this passage. They could experience hatred. They could experience division within their family or from their family. They could potentially experience death. If Jesus was talking to us today, he'd probably warn us that there are those in power that will call us woke when we care about other people or care about the justice issues of minority groups. We might be warned that empathy will be considered a fundamental weakness of civilization, that caring for the foreigner, as we are taught by both Old and New Testaments, it could make you become labeled as a domestic terrorist. This is just the current iteration of what Jesus was warning his disciples about. Different culture, different time, same results. When goodness rises up, evil will rise up in a counterattack. But we get to choose which side we give our energy and loyalty to. Choosing God's kingdom is the better way, I would argue, but it's not necessarily the easier way. So Joyce is going to come read to us Matthew 10, 24 through 42, and it does end with a pretty positive image.
Matthew 10, 24 through 42. Disciples aren't greater than their teacher, and slaves aren't greater than their master. It's enough for disciples to be like their teacher and slaves like their master. If they have called the head of the house Beelzebul, it's certain that they will call the members of his household by even worse names. Therefore, don't be afraid of those people, because nothing is hidden that won't be revealed, and nothing secret that won't be brought out into the open. What I say to you in the darkness, tell in the light, and what you hear whispered, announce from the rooftops. Don't be afraid of those who kill the body, but can't kill the soul. Instead, be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Aren't two sparrows sold for a small coin? But not one of them will fall to the ground without your Father knowing about it already. Even the hairs of your head are all counted. Don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. Therefore, everyone who acknowledges me before people, I also will acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But everyone who denies me before people, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven. Don't think that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I haven't come to bring peace, but a sword. I've come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. People's enemies are members of their own household. Those who love father or mother more than me aren't worthy of me. Those who love son or daughter more than me aren't worthy of me. Those who don't pick up their crosses and follow me aren't worthy of me. Those who find their lives will lose them, and those who lose their lives because of me will find them. Those who receive you also are receiving me, and those who receive me are receiving the one who sent me. Those who receive a prophet as a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. Those who receive a righteous person as a righteous person will receive a righteous person's reward. I assure you that everybody who gives even a cup of cold water to these little ones because they are my disciples will certainly be rewarded. The word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
I watch a TV show where one of the main characters says, woof, when he hears something that he doesn't really like or that's challenging. And when I hear this passage saying, you know, we're going to make daughter rise up against mother, or Jesus won't be the way of peace, and whatever they've done to Jesus, they'll do worse to you. I want to say, woof, as in ouch or ick or ugh. But Jesus wasn't wrong. Maybe we've all felt it when we've stood up for the gospel of mercy and compassion when other people want someone to suffer or be punished. When we speak of the need of grace rather than retribution, especially in a country that still practices the death penalty. Or maybe you've just been given a hard time because you gave a dollar to someone in need and the person you were with didn't think that person was worthy. Perhaps you have a faith life and other members of your family don't. And either blatantly or covertly, they make you feel like they're kind of judging you for being maybe so silly as to believe in God. Jesus warns us that if we care about what other people think more than we care about him, then we're going to be pulled off course from being his disciple. We may have to give up some of our most important human connections, but our connection to Jesus and to God is much more important. Now, some people, I think, read that as a challenge, and they want to be so pushy with their beliefs that it's almost like they feel like if they haven't irritated their entire family, then they haven't been disciples. I don't think that's what Jesus is suggesting. In fact, we've read in other places that he told his disciples, if you go to someone's house or to a town and they don't welcome you, just leave. Brush the dust off your hands and feet and just don't waste your wisdom on someone that isn't wanting to hear. That's good advice for us. But we also have to be prepared for reactions that could be so great that it severs a relationship. But even though parts of this discourse sounded brutal, it ended with a beautiful and really extravagant statement of grace. We don't earn our way into grace. And to make that point, Jesus says, hey, if someone gives you, a disciple, a cup of water, they get the same reward that you did. If someone welcomes a prophet in, they get the same reward as the prophet. It's the most basic act of hospitality, giving someone a cup of water. You could ask, like, who hasn't done that at some point in their life? That's quite the counterpoint to the whole, if you deny me, I'll deny you speech. You have to study what Jesus is like to decide which of those statements maybe is more true. It's kind of the extravagant generosity we saw in the parable of the landowner who hired people on the last hour of the day and people at the first hour of the day and all the way in between and paid them all the same. Same reward, different levels of commitment or work. So we do well to remember this standard before we're tempted to judge and say, oh man, that person's going to hell. Well, you know what? They probably gave somebody a cup of water at some point. That's a pretty low bar. Just saying. Now, there's lots of Christians that I'm aware of who are really concerned about saving souls, bringing souls to Jesus. And I kind of want to tell them about this passage and suggest that rather than they use their words and try to coerce people into becoming a convert and becoming a Christian, just go ask them for a drink of water. If they give you one, they're in. Your work is done. But somehow that doesn't quite satisfy the evangelical itch that they have, right? That need to be right. So last Sunday, I was hiking in that desert through an archaeological site, and I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to get to church. So whenever that happens, I just think, okay, well, this is part of church for me today. I did actually get to go to Mass that day, but on that morning, it's not hard to be in awe in a place like that. But along the route, we came upon a plaque honoring a Chilean woman who is Gabriela Mistral, and she was the first Latin American woman to earn a Nobel Prize, and she earned it in 1945 in the area of literature. And the plaque held one of her poems. And the guide gratefully translated it for me. And after he read it, I was like, well, there was my sermon for the day. It is so beautiful. I'm going to end by sharing it with you. It's been translated into English by various sources, so you may find other variations, just slight differences. But it's called To Serve. All of nature is a yearning for service. The cloud serves. The wind and the furrow. Where there is a tree to plant, you be the one. Where there is a mistake to undo, let it be you. You be the one to remove the rock from the path, the hate from human hearts, and the difficulties from the problem. There is joy in being wise and just, but above all, there is the beautiful, the immense happiness of serving. How sad the world would be if all was already done. If there was no rose bush to plant, no enterprise to undertake. Do not limit yourself to easy tasks. It's so beautiful to do what others dodge. But don't fall prey to the error that only great tasks done can be accounted as accomplishments. There are small acts of service that are good ones. Decoratively setting a table, putting some books in order, combing a little girl's hair. That one over there is the one that criticizes. This other one is the one that destroys. You be the one that serves. Serving is not a labor just for inferior beings. God, who gives fruit and light, serves. His name could be rendered thus, He who serves. And He has His eyes on our hands. And He asks us at the close of the day, did you render service today? To whom? To a tree? To a friend? To your mother? On this Father's Day, let us remember we are the children of He who serves. And as children, let us do likewise. Amen.